Hello. Welcome to the April 2015 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan, or This Month in Other Journals Besides the AJNR. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 7 articles from the recent literature that I've found of interest, with no particular theme this month, and I hope you'll find them of interest as well. As always, the references that I'm discussing will all be posted onto the AJNR blog, so no need to write anything down. The first paper I want to mention has a first author of Eduardo Benaroche, and it's entitled The Amygdala, Functional Organization and Involvement in Neurologic Disorders. This is from Neurology in 2015. This is a detailed, and I do mean detailed, review of functional organization of the amygdala, which includes both intrinsic and extrinsic connections, physiology, and its function in humans. Examples that are given of clinical correlations include Kluver-Bucy syndrome, lipoid proteinosis, which we all know as Urbach-Wythe disease, and a variety of other neurometabolic diseases. Kluver-Bucy is characterized by visual agnosia, oral exploration of objects, excessive visual attentiveness, and altered sexual behavior. Lipoid proteinosis is an autosomal recessive disorder with a mutation in the extracellular matrix protein 1 gene. Now, fMRI studies have shown that the amygdala is important in defining a response to fearful facial expressions. And I found it interesting that this response does not even require an intact visual cortex. There is an fMRI study in a patient with cortical blindness that showed amygdala activation in response to faces directed towards the viewer. And that article has a first author of Burra, B-U-R-R-A, and it's entitled Amygdala Activation for Eye Contact Despite Complete Cortical Blindness. That's from the Journal of Neuroscience in 2013. Now, the next paper has a first author of Nora Chaluri, and it's entitled Treatment of Ruptured Intracranial Aneurysms with the Pipeline Embolization Device. This is from Neurosurgery in 2015. The authors present a case series of 20 patients with ruptured aneurysms who were treated with the pipeline embolization device. Mean duration from hemorrhage to placement of the pipeline was 7 days. Adjunctive coil placement was used in 30%. The one complication which occurred was a fatal intraoperative aneurysm dome rupture during adjunctive coil deployment. Follow-up angiography at a mean of 5 months showed 100% occlusion in 80% of the patients and incomplete occlusion in 20%. They conclude that treatment of ruptured aneurysms with the pipeline has a low complication rate and high occlusion rate and may be safe and effective option for aneurysms difficult to treat with conventional methods. There are 5 figures included in this article. The patients in this study were loaded with aspirin and clopidogrel or received an infusion of Aggrastat intraoperatively. This discussion gives a nice summary of the controversies and difficulties treating acutely ruptured aneurysm patients with dual antiplatelet therapy. They also give their general guidelines for who and what to treat, such as use with wide neck or blister aneurysms, pseudoaneurysms, or giant or dissecting aneurysms. They also favor Hunt and Hess grades 3 or less, since these patients less frequently require invasive procedures that might increase morbidity in the face of dual antiplatelet therapy. The third article I want to mention has a first author of Aaron Flanagan, and it's entitled Short Myelitis Lesions in Aquaporin 4 IgG Positive Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorders. This is from JAMA Neurology in 2015. Longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis, which is defined on MR as extending 3 or more vertebral segments, is the most specific radiologic finding supporting neuromyelitis optica, or NMO, in adults and should prompt physicians to test for aquaporin 4 IgG. Short transverse myelitis lesions, defined by MR as not extending three vertebral segments, is much more common in multiple sclerosis than in NMO. The authors wanted to determine the frequency of short lesions at the initial myelitis manifestation of NMO and to compare the demographic, clinical, and radiologic characteristics of aquaporin 4 IgG seropositive and seronegative short transverse myelitis lesions. Patients at the Mayo Clinic were identified as aquaporin 4 IgG positive from 1996 to 2014. 25 patients who were aquaporin 4 IgG seropositive with an initial short transverse myelitis were 14% of initial myelitis episodes among patients with NMO spectrum disorder. Delay to diagnosis and treatment was greater when initial lesions were short. Subsequent myelitis episodes were longitudinally extensive in 92%. They conclude that short transverse myelitis does not exclude consideration of aquaporin 4 IgG testing. There are three figures included in this article. In the discussion, the authors point out the clinical importance of making the distinction between MS and NMO, since therapies favored in MS may exacerbate NMO, such as interferon beta. And I refer you to the paper by first author of Kim, with a title, Does Interferon Beta Treatment Exacerbate Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorder? And that's in Multiple Sclerosis in 2012. The fourth paper I want to discuss has a first author of Jeffrey Gelfand, and it's entitled Encephalitis of Unclear Origin Diagnosed by Brain Biopsy. This is from JAMA Neurology in 2015. In this retrospective case series, the authors looked at patients with encephalitis diagnosed by brain biopsy from January 1983 through December of 2011, and the number was 58, with an original pathologic diagnosis of encephalitis not otherwise specified, or ENOS. In 29 patients where pathological material was available, additional review led to a more specific diagnosis in 34%. Despite comprehensive review with additional information and studies, 27 patients were still classified as encephalitis not otherwise specified. The authors conclude that these patients remain a diagnostic challenge and that current algorithms are of limited value. Kind of a depressing conclusion. The final, more specific categorizations or diagnoses that they found were quite varied and included LGI1 limbic encephalitis, paraneoplastic encephalitis with the MA2 antibodies, gliomatosis cerebri, lymphoma, listeria, TB, HSV2, and toxoplasmosis, among others. The fifth paper I want to talk about has authors of Joseph Buchwalter, Vernon Tolo, and Regis O'Keefe, and it's entitled, How Do You Know It Is True? Integrity in Research and Publications. This is an AOA Criticals issue from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery in 2015. This is an excellent overview of research integrity with examples of fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism in the recent literature. If you want to publish or have published, you should read this article. They give examples. Fabrication involves the presentation of observations or events that, in fact, never occurred, so someone made up the experiments. The article highlights one of the most notorious cases of fabrication, that of Dr. Scott Rubin, who published a series of articles evaluating COX-2 inhibitors for postoperative pain. Starting in 2008, it was discovered that some of the studies did not have IRB approval, and eventually led to the requested retraction of 21 papers. These papers had been widely touted, and it was stated that these fabricated studies led to the sale of billions of dollars of COX-2 inhibitors. Falsification involves the modification of scientific data so that it supports a particular hypothesis. The example cited in this article is that of Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who published a study in 1998 suggesting a link between vaccination and autism. A retrospective review of Wakefield's data showed that the diagnosis and or dates of records were changed for all 12 children in the publication so as to support the author's conclusions. The Lancet issued a full retraction, but the taint on the use of vaccines remains. The sixth paper I want to look at has a first author of Helen Kim, and it is entitled Validation of the Supplemented Spetzler-Martin Grading System for Brain Arteriovenous Malformations in a Multicenter Cohort of 1,009 Surgical Patients. This is from Neurosurgery in 2015. The supplementary grading system for brain AVMs was introduced in 2010 for improving preoperative risk prediction and selecting patients for surgery, and awards points for the ABCs of AVMs. The first one is patient age, the second is bleeding or hemorrhagic presentation, and the third is AVM compactness. In an analogous fashion to the scoring of the Spetzler-Martin system, patients less than 20 years are assigned 1 point, 20 to 40 years of age given 2 points, and greater than 40 years given 3 points. Unruptured AVMs are given 1 point, and with a rupture, given 0 points. Diffuse AVMs are given 1 point, compact AVMs, 0 points. So in this study, data collected from 1,009 AVM patients who underwent resection were used to compare the predictive powers of the Spetzler-Martin by itself and Spetzler-Martin supplementary grades. The Spetzler-Martin supplementary system performed better than the Spetzler-Martin system alone. Area under the receiver operating characteristics curve was 0.75. They conclude that the study validates the predictive accuracy of the Spetzler-Martin supplementary system in a multicenter cohort. The Spetzler-Martin supplementary grade of 6 is a cutoff or a boundary for AVM operability. The discussion section is particularly useful for the explanation of the individual elements of the supplementary system. Age, younger patients better tolerate surgery and have more neuroplasticity. Hemorrhage is seen actually as improving operative chances since it provides a better surgical corridor and a ready-made parenchymal dissection plane, hence 0 points for the presence of hemorrhage. Compact AVMs allow for a separation from adjacent parenchyma and have no intermixed brain. And the seventh and final paper for this session has a first author by Ning Lin, and it is entitled Use of Coils in Conjunction with Pipeline Embolization Device for Treatment of Intracranial Aneurysms, and this is in Neurosurgery in 2015. This case-controlled study looked at 29 patients treated with pipeline plus coils and 75 patients treated with pipeline only. No statistically significant between-group differences were found in terms of age, sex, aneurysm location, medical comorbidities, and length of follow-up. Complete aneurysm occlusion was achieved in a higher proportion of the pipeline plus coils group. That was 93% versus 74%. The rates of neurological complications and favorable outcomes were similar. The authors conclude that pipeline plus coils may be safe and effective treatment for aneurysms with a high risk of rupture. There are 4 figures included in this paper. In the discussion, the authors caution against dense packing of the coils when the pipeline is used, since a dense coil pack could result in mass effect on the pipeline and cause device thrombosis. Well, thank you very much for sticking with me to the end. If you have any feedback on this podcast, please email me with your constructive criticism or effusive praise, and that would be at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. Again, that's ajnr.eic@gmail.com. Till next time, thanks so much for listening.